Welcome to this Cosmos Online podcast. I'm Jean Hoffman. Today I'm talking with Professor Pete Becky about his new book, Living Economics, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Dr. Becky is the Deputy Director of the James M. Buchanan Center for Political Economy, a Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center, and a professor in the Economics Department at George Mason University. Welcome, Professor Becky, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jean. It's great to be here.
So what is living economics, and why did you decide to write a book about it?
Well, the title is meant to capture three different things, as well as the picture on the cover, which is a tree, a big, giant tree. And that is that economics is a living body of thought, constantly changing and moving in new directions, depending on the problems that are confronted at the time, and that this is an open invitation of inquiry to people that engage in economics to constantly be learning from the discipline or anything like that. So that's the first meaning. And then there's another meaning, which is if you look at the tree is sort of grows strong and tall and sturdy because it's rooted in something. And those are the roots that we want to look at as the intellectual history and traditions from which the science of economics grows from. And that's in Adam Smith, and then in David Hume and Adam Smith, and the argument in the book, it's David Hume and Adam Smith and John Baptiste Say, and then in the 20th century, early part of the 20th century, people like Karl Menger, Bombavrik, Mises, Hayek. And then in the latter part of the 20th century, from post 1950 onwards, the story that emerges is about the ideas that have come about from James Buchanan, Ronald Coase, Armin Alchin, Israel Kirzner, Vernon Smith, and sort of this developing on body of economics, which focuses on exchange and the institutions within which exchange takes place. And then the third point of the title is that if you sort of believe in this body of economics and you come to see the world through the economic lens or the economic way of thinking, then economics is a 24/7 occupation. It's not a 9-to-5 job. You actually end up by living economics. Everything that you see is through the eyes of an economist, whether or not it's the most, mundane things in the world or the most profound things. And so, the book sort of tries to communicate that excitement about the economic way of thinking and how it's a key to unlocking, like, all the mysteries in the world. Yeah. So it has these three different, meanings, and that's what, the title tries to capture, and the book reflects various different parts of that. The book is divided into three parts, the first part of which is what is the core teachings of economics. The second part is a set of biographical, intellectual biographies of individuals who were outstanding teachers of the core body of economics. And then the third part is the implications for the way we do our economics if those core lessons were taken to be true and the teachings of those great masters of the core lessons are taken to be true. How would we envision an economics profession?
So what sparked the idea for the book in the first place?
Well, a lot of the material in the book is made up from essays that I've written over the last 25 years in my economics career. But the idea of bringing them together and revising them and placing them in certain ways that they did, that came from a trip that I went on with Chris Coyne a year ago at the University Francisco Marroquin, who was the co-publisher of the book. At the University of Francisco Marroquin, their motto is 40 years, one mission. And that mission is the exploration into the institutional foundations for a society of free and responsible individuals, right? And so everything at that university, which is a fascinating place, and everything at the university is attention to detail that relate to that mission. So that I should point out that it's a university that was founded by and run by businessmen, not other academics. And as a result, they pay attention to details in a way academics don't. The academics, in general, paint with a very broad brush, and they're absent-minded and things like that, and they wouldn't pay attention to all the little details. At UFM, everything from their coffee mugs to, you know, the way they design the architecture of their buildings to the sort of what's on the walls and everything is designed to fit with that mission. So as you walk through the campus, what you see is sculptures, the building names, the sayings that are on. They have constant, you know, murals with pictures of classical economists and descriptions of their main ideas, or a giant wall, you know, that has, you know, quotes from Milton Friedman explaining about how once the public opinion is shifted, how, you know, you can have social change. And auditoriums are named after, you know, Hayek and Friedman, and, you know, the library is named after Mises and everything. So every place that you turn, there's centers and research centers at the place and at the university, and images of all of these great thinkers in economics and their ideas. So not just the people, but the ideas, and the institution is all designed to do that. So when Chris and I were flying back from there, we were very inspired by the commitment that the faculty at UFM has to teaching, not only economics, but to teaching people how to learn everything, philosophy, politics, economics, history. So just another little background about UFM. Every student, whether or not they're in the architectural program, in the medical school, in the dental program, in the law school, business school, or whatever, has to take a sequence of courses on the great ideas of classical liberal thinkers. So everyone is exposed to these ideas, even however remote they are from the field. And so we were very inspired, Chris and I, and came back, and we were talking about what ways that, what kind of projects might come out of this, inspiring visit. And one of the things I was thinking was, well, you know, there's this mural that they have. I know this is a radio or an online thing, that audio, but they have this mural that stretches. I'm going to show the mural to Gene.
And here, I can post it in the
and I can send you send you the JPEG of it. But this is the mural that covers their economics building. So it starts here with Cantillon, right? And it stretches through all the great thinkers, and this wraps around the wall as you walk through the economics department. So outside of the economics department, before you get to this, there's a mural that has the Spanish scholastics, the great scholastic thinkers that many people attribute to being the foundations of economics. And then what happens is you wrap around, and then you come along this mural, which goes through their timeline of the history of economic ideas. And it, you know, goes from, you know, Cantillon, you know, up through eventually to Adam Smith, and then all the way up to Vernon Smith, right? And it's this amazing sort of idea. And if you look at this thing and you look at my own career, I have written something almost on all the various different people all the way through it. So I was constantly obsessed with this mural. I would go, we were there for a 2-week visit where we were teaching but also consulting the university as it's developed different programs. That's why Chris and I were there. And I would go by it every day and like look at it and sit there and say, like, this is amazing, because my own tastes, you know, because I never thought about having anything unified. If you would have asked me 25 years ago, do you have a unified research program when you go to decide to write about people? It's like, no, it's like whoever interests me at the moment. Like, you know, right? That's like the topic. You know, that's one of the things that's most fascinating about being a scholar, right? Is that, you know, curiosity may kill the cat, but it fuels the scholar. So everything, what we want to do is encourage curiosity, right? And so it's like, are you intellectually curious? And then, you know, go wherever that will take you. That's part of free inquiry. It just so happens my free inquiry has all been on these different things. So I was like, you know, man, that's kind of interesting. Maybe there's something there to that. Plus, I had given lectures while I was there about how to teach, because their main focus at UFM is a teaching university, not really a research university. They have some research components there, and people are trying really hard. They have a Vernon Smith experimental lab. that is, you know, doing a lot of research, and they have a Israel Kirzner Center for Entrepreneurship, and people there are doing stuff with the GEM, the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor. And so they do have researchers there, but most of it is about teaching. Right? It's about teaching the core ideas. And so they have a center, David Hume, which is about teaching, you know, classical Scottish philosophy. They have a center, Henry Hazlitt, which is about teaching principles of economics. And the people in the center, Henry Hazlitt, are the most devoted teachers I've ever met. And so that was also inspiring, because both Chris and I really care about teaching. And we were like, okay, well, I've written on teaching as well. So what's the connection between this mural and also the teaching? Well, when you teach, you want to teach the ideas that are represented in the guys that are, or girls that are on this mural, right? And because those are the main ideas in economics. That's what it means to, you know, do economics, is to work in that area of basically what I summarize it as, is reconciling the rational choice hypothesis with the invisible hand hypothesis, or postulate, whichever one you want to use there. And not by collapsing one to the other, but instead deriving the one out of the other, right? So you derive the invisible hand proposition out of the rationality postulate, right? And the way that you do that is through institutional analysis. So there you have the three things that have been taught in economics from Adam Smith all the way up to Vernon Smith, which is you have rationality, you have institutional analysis, and you have the invisible hand. And that's what constitutes economics, the main line of economics, as I refer to it in here, which is a term I got from one of my professors. And it's in trying to understand that project and teaching that project. So one, understanding that intellectual project, which is a scholarly exercise. But then once you get some grasp on it, how do you communicate that to people? And UFM seemed like this amazing focus on how do you communicate those ideas. And they're constantly learning in their experience. So rather than just doing chalk and talk, now they're all involved in Socratic seminars. Mm-hmm. So you will know these people, but not everyone out there in the internet will know them. But like Michael Strong was brought in to talk about that. And now they have this guy, Bert Lohn, who's down there. And their president of UFM is this very, very inspiring person, the current president, Giancarlo Ibargüen. And he's a very, very inspiring person. He got an honorary doctorate last year in Spain. And on that occasion, he gave out a speech on the purpose of education, and it was all about the role of students having ownership over their education, more dialogue, engagement, sort of a spontaneous order idea, free inquiry in the classroom. So they have a whole new college now. I was just down there 2 weeks ago, and they have a whole new college now, which wasn't there when Chris was there a year ago, called the Michael Polanyi College. And the Michael Polanyi College, and the main seminar room in the Michael Polanyi College, is called the Carl Menger Seminar Room, by the way. This is what I mean by paying attention to all these little details. Yeah. But that's a purely Socratic dialogue, you know, education that the kids can get. So the classes are all set up in that way. And so, again, you know, not only is it about the ideas, but then the way that you communicate the ideas. And that trip to UFM really sort of, you know, clicked. And so then I came back and you know, talked to Giancarlo about the idea of maybe doing the book. They were excited about it. And then Independent Institute handled the production and distribution in the United States. UFM is a co-publisher, and a Spanish edition will be available within the next 6 months as well.
Great. So then does that mean that your primary audience are teachers?
It's probably a very good book for a kid who is an IHS kid who graduates from undergraduate school and has committed to going to graduate school, but before they go to graduate school, okay? Mm-hmm. Or after they get out of graduate school and they are becoming teachers of economics. So those two sort of audiences are the main sort of target.
Okay.
Mainly because I believe that on the nature of the way in which we do our economics, you have to decide. So George Stigler, a great economist at the University of Chicago, said that you should only do methodology once in your life. That is when you're really old and you reflect back on your career. And I always thought Stigler got this wrong by one, which is that you also have to decide what kind of economist you want to be before you start training. Because if you just adopt whole cloth whatever the profession says you should be doing at this time, you never really escape from it, or you never really think seriously about it. So when you're a young kid deciding, okay, I want to be an economist, or I want to be a historian, or I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be like that, you should spend a lot of time and think to yourself, like, what kind of scholar do I want to be? What are the projects that interest me? You know, where am I going to learn the best about doing that? And so I think that that period of time after you've been in undergraduate school and decided you want to become an economist, but before you've actually been technically trained to be an economist. I mean, this is the biggest mistake most undergraduates make, is that they don't realize that they're not technically trained to be an economist by getting an undergraduate degree. They're trained to, like, maybe learn economics. They haven't learned economics yet. And so that's the first thing that you have to do to them when they first get to graduate school, is beat the cockiness out of them. Just because they got an A at, you know, whatever school doesn't mean they actually know economics. But they have to think to themselves about, okay, how do I want to approach economic problems? And so at that point, methodology is really important. And then once they decide that, then they go and acquire the tools and whatever that's necessary for the projects they want to pursue. So let's say that I wanted to be an area studies economist, right? So, like, what I want to do is, I don't want to be an economic theorist, so I don't want to write on a blackboard. But what I want to do is, I want to learn to be able to study Italian economic development, right? Well, the very first thing I need to do is I need to know how to speak Italian, right? I also need to know how to be a historian. I can't just read, like, a book and say, oh, I'm going to, you know, one book or something like that. And so that means that you're going to invest time and effort in learning those skills, which, if I was an economist that said, I want to study antitrust policy in the United States, right, I wouldn't do that. Or if I want to study monetary economics, right? And so it's very important, I think, in the beginning of your graduate career, or before you even begin grad school, to think, what kind of economist do I want to be? And then when you finish graduate school, what kind of teacher do I want to be? The vast majority of academic jobs are teaching jobs, not research jobs. The research jobs I'm fortunate that I was able to have one of those jobs. And when I got out of graduate school, I first went to a school which was a teaching job. I was ABD. I was there for 2 years. I got my doctorate degree in my first year, and then I moved on to NYU. At NYU, I had a very low teaching load, very high research expectations, but a very low teaching load. And I was at NYU, fortunate to work with Israel Kirzner and Mario Rizzo for 8 years. And then I moved to another school, which was primarily a teaching school, though I was the quote-unquote research director of the business school, and what had certain expectations because of their requirements for their accreditation issue, research-wise. But primarily, we were teachers. That's what we did. We were teachers of economics. And then I had the opportunity to move to George Mason, where, again, I teach graduate students, which means that my teaching load's lower and my responsibilities are mainly research-oriented. But most of my students here go into teaching of economics. And what kind of teacher do they want to be? You know, do they want to be the kind of teacher that the, you know, students hate because they're boring and, you know, they don't pay much attention to them? Or do they make teaching like a vocation, a worthy thing? And so part of what the book is about is also communicating the idea about the worthiness of being a teacher of economics, and that you shouldn't be viewed as, you know, a second-class citizen if you devote your life to teaching something. Because, again, if you go back to this long heritage of these great ideas, communicating the insights of an Adam Smith and a David Hume, or of a Jean-Baptiste Say, or of a Jim Buchanan, or an F.A. Hayek, or whatever, that is a amazingly worthy vocation as a communicator of economic ideas. And so I think that when you get done with graduate school and you're getting your job, you should think to yourself, what kind of teacher do I want to be? Do I want to just approach my teaching as teaching watered-down graduate courses because that's what I just had and I can minimize my preparation and therefore bore students or whatever? No. I want to try to be a lively and engaging professor of a subject so that 20 years from now, 30 years from now, students will say, geez, that professor, you know, had a transformative experience in my life. I now know things about economics which I never wouldn't have known before. So that's, I think, also an audience for the book.
Yeah. Okay. So in Living Economics, you use the term mainline economics. Mm-hmm. What does that term mean, and how does it differ from what we think of as mainstream economic thought?
Yeah. So I contrast mainline with mainstream throughout the book. That is a distinction that comes from, originally I first heard of the term mainline economics from one of my professors, Kenneth Boulding, who actually was one of the first John Bates Clark Award winners. What happened was, Boulding was a very fast rising superstar in economics, and he became disillusioned with the way economics was moving in the Samuelsonian direction. And so one of my favorite essays of Boulding's is actually called After Samuelson, Who Needs Smith? And his argument is we all do, because Samuelson hasn't exhausted all the insights from Adam Smith. But early on, he wrote a review of Samuelson's foundations in the Journal of Political Economy, which was also quite a challenge to the idea that Samuelsonian economics, or what could be represented as the sort of hyper-mathemization of economics, was an advance forward. And so that put him in a slightly out of sync kind of position, even though he was a famous person. I mean, a president of the American Economic Association and all that kind of stuff. And so I take mainline economics to be what are the core propositions of economics, and mainstream economics to be a sociological designation that means what's currently fashionable among the current elite in the profession. And there's a lot of times in which the mainline, the core propositions, you know, Lord Acton has this great line where he says, it's the men who sit in the seat of Adam Smith that are worthy of our attention, right? Mainline are the people who sit in the seat of Adam Smith. And so, you know, in my rendering, that, you know, goes from Smith and Hume all the way up to, you know, through the Austrians, but also in modern times, people like that are in the book, for example, Eleanor Ostrom. There's two chapters on the Ostroms and on Eleanor Ostrom, and another chapter, one chapter on Kenneth Boulding, but another chapter on Gordon Tullock and Murray Rothbard. I mean, so I mix up the different, you know, things, but what makes these people common? It's certainly not that they call themselves, you know, Austrians or even classical liberals. What unites them is that they believe in the core propositions of economics. The idea of the market as a self-organizing system, that individuals are fallible but capable human choosers, that they always exist within institutional environments. And so the main thing is, you know, looking at that institutional environment, right? And whether or not it's conducive to growth or not, right? And so, mainline, you know, another way to think about this is imagine that you had a time machine and you went back in time and you found yourself in the 19th century, Charles Dickens's time, and you met Charles Dickens and you said, I'm an economist. What would Charles Dickens think that you believed? Now let's fast forward and you end up with John Steinbeck. So you're in the 1930s. And you say to John Dickens, Steinbeck, you say, I'm an economist. What's he going to actually believe, you think? There's something common there between the two of those things, right? So if you read Dickens's Hard Times, right, he's criticizing economics. That's what that book is about. And these are the philosophers of fact, these British utilitarians that he's criticizing. And what do they believe? They basically believe in the self-regulation of the market, the rationality of the individuals to calculate the costs and benefits of their decisions, and that individuals, by calculating these costs and benefits, even though they have divergent interest, when they calculate them and they engage in exchange, they end up by producing this self-regulating order, which he thinks isn't true, right? So he's not a mainline economist, Dickens. He's a critic of mainline economics. But what he thinks economists believed is this body of thought. Well, if you go to to Steinbeck in the 1930s, right? You know, we the people, Paul, we keep a coming, right? Mm-hmm. Right? It's the populist critique of economics, mm-hmm. right? That's what's going on there. And so one of the things I wanted to try to capture is this continuing line of thought throughout the continuity, you know, between that. So one of my teaching experiments was when I was at NYU, I taught an honors principles course. Very bright kids in that class, and many of them gone on to very successful careers afterwards, not all academics, but, you know, in high finance and in computer science and whatnot. It was a really great class that I had. But I used as the textbook The Wealth of Nations, Alfred Marshall's Principles of Economics, and Joe Stiglitz's book. This is in the early 90s, and Stiglitz had just come out with a book called Economics, which people thought was going to be a big successful book. And the point of the exercise, what is the continuities and discontinuities in the history of economics? And, you know, we sort of, you know, dove into all that. Well, that's what's, again, going through this idea. What is those continuities and discontinuities? And so my idea is that when a lot of times in history, mainstream economics dovetails with the main line. Like an example would be Milton Friedman. Okay, in which his ideas sort of were victorious and won or whatever. But it's precisely at those points in time when schools of thought, various different schools of thought, are not that important, because that's just what economics teaches. But when the mainstream deviates significantly from the main line, you need these acts of intellectual entrepreneurship in which schools of thought then become very important. So part of the story of the book is also in the post-1950 era, the role that various different schools of thought played in bringing economics back to appreciating specifically this institutional environment within which rational choosers choose that can generate, you know, the self-regulation of the market. So, for example, property rights economics and the role that Armin Alchin and Harold Demsetz and those people played in that. Public choice economics, right? Which is, Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock and the role that they played in all of that. Governance economics, which is Oliver Williamson and Eleanor Ostrom and bringing those ideas all back. One of the things that's interesting when you think back about it is that these are not ideas that Adam Smith would have found all that unusual. Ronald Coase, in his famous FCC paper in 1959, has a great passage where he says, "My novel theory," and then he has in parentheses, "novel, that is, if you haven't read Adam Smith." And so, to a large extent, what mainline economics is the continuing body of thought that comes out of Adam Smith and David Hume, and its various different articulations by different thinkers to capture that sort of central idea. And, you know, and so that's kind of, you know, where the master teachers come in getting that approach across.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Professor Becky.
I greatly appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you. And his book, again, is Living Economics, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Tune in next week for part two of our interview with Dr. Becky, where we'll talk about teaching economics and good economics versus good politics. For more interviews with leading scholars, visit cosmosonline.org. And this is Jean Hoffman signing off.